It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley in New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 168th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 167 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com. My last piece for the West is a Guardian, the 12th episode of the Creative Disruption series, is still available, or it was this morning, at www.westchesterguardian.com. And West is a Guardian is W-E-S-T-C-H-E-S-T-R-G-U-A-R-D-I-A-N, all one word. This is September 29th issue of the paper, which unfortunately is the last issue of the paper, which has now joined the New York Herald Tribune, the New York Journal of America, the Washington Star, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles pertaining to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion and technology. Try it and subscribe. It's only one email a day and it's free. I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live or as most to listen later. The recordings are archived at the website that I mentioned. I hope you'll join us next week for my discussion with Detroit-based journalist and opinion writer Kristen Palm. And now to this show, the 168th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is another product of God's country, Inwood, that little bit of heaven at the northern end of Manhattan Island in New York City, Kevin Reynolds. Kevin is the next NYPD officer, the now fledgling documentarian. He's also a massage therapist. We'll go into his life and his new project, the project that centers on the personal tragedy in his own life. We'll get into all this tonight on tonight's John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Kevin, and welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, John. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Now, let's get right to it. What are your earliest memories of growing up in Inwood?
Playing in the street, coming down from the fifth floor and being on Academy Street there. And I think I was out there before I got into the first grade. It was safe for kids to be out there and to play.
There were at least two Reynolds families in close proximity on Academy Street. I was friendly with Joe and Farrah Reynolds, cousins in my age. In fact, Joe and I have been close over the years. Can you give us the who's who of the overall Reynolds clan?
Well, Farrell, the oldest was Kevin, Rosalind, Farrell, and Peter lived in 603 Academy, as did I live there with my brother Richard and Brian. And then in the next building over, maybe at 609, was Joe Reynolds' family, Joe, Tom, and Johnny.
And for you, like the rest of us, it was Good Shepherd Grammar School to begin with. And then what?
After Good Shepherd Grammar School, I went to Manhattan Prep. You know, a little bit pressed to go there. My mother wanted to impress the neighbors, and it was a little bit over my head, and I was struggling a bit through the teenage years. So I spent 2 years there, and then I transferred down to Bishop Dubois high school down in 152nd Street.
And, you know, to me, you mentioned the contemporary and close friend of mine, Bob Gorman. Did you know him as both the teacher and as a basketball coach?
Yes. And believe it or not, you know, Bob had a reputation in the neighborhood, but he was the best teacher I ever had in my life. He was my math teacher at Bishop Dubois, and he was also a great basketball coach. I played under him for 2 years in CYO play out of Good Shepherd.
Bob, unfortunately, died young. Bob for a number of years had the problem with the bottle, and he actually went into a coma, a liver coma, for 7 weeks in Jewish Memorial Hospital, and he woke up with Father Curtin giving him the last rites, and they told him, if you have anything more to drink, don't bother coming here, go right to Al Connors. And he stayed off it for well over a year. I was with him at Jerry Moran's wake, and he was fine, and his mother was very happy. And then about a year later, Jerry's mother called me and told me that Bob died. And I said, did he start drinking again? And she said, yes. Then I got infuriated, which I shouldn't have. He was dead. But then when I talked to two people who had met him in the preceding year, they said he was extremely lonely, that he didn't want to go into bars because he was afraid that he'd drink, and all his friends hung around in there, and he didn't have a job then. He was out of teaching. And they met him both at basketball games and walking around the park. So maybe, unfortunately, he decided to go out his own way, you know, to go out the way that he was happy. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, sad. Very sad.
Had you always wanted to be the cop? My father, grandfather, and godfather were all NYPD.
No, John, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And my parents were immigrants, and they pressed me that civil service was the way to go, that, you know, a 20-year stay and you get a 50% of your pay as a pension. So they were pressing me to do something with my life. I was a bit confused and, you know, had a hard time getting the concept of college into my head. So I took the police test, and right after high school, I started working for the police department as a civilian. And I did that for almost 3 years. And when I turned 21, I automatically became a police officer.
Oh, I didn't realize they had the program like that, that was automatic.
I tend to think that the program was put in there to protect some people because we were draft exempt. So it's my theory that the city created the program in order for certain people to protect their children.
How long were you on the job?
Well, I turned a police officer in May of 1970, and I left in July of 77.
Okay. You mentioned in the same note that I referenced above that one of the officers that you worked with was another Inwood neighborhood, Tom Collins. Tom had been in Vietnam and was one of the servicemen who had a beer care package delivered from home by another old friend of mine, John Charles Chick Donahue, who joins us now. Good evening, Chick.
Good evening, John. Good evening.
Chick's beer run is the subject of an internet video that's gone viral and is the core of an upcoming book by Chick, co-written with the Dex Daily News columnist Joanna Malloy. Chick, sit tight for a few minutes. I'll bring you back in when we return to Vietnam. Okay.
Great. Just remind me which Reynolds is talking to us here.
The good-looking one.
They all would have said the same thing. Okay.
Before you came on, he went through the whole Reynolds liturgy for us, and he was the...
Oh, okay.
There were three families. There was the Joe family the Farrell's family and Kevin's family, that was the third family, all on Academy Street, right around each other.
So, wow.
Okay.
You know, I went into Chambers when I was 18, and I walked in, and Harry said, I think whatever his name was, Harry said to me, you know, I said, well, my name is Kevin Reynolds, and my cousin is here. And he said, I didn't ask you what your religion was.
The mention of Vietnam brings up the impetus for your first documentary, Kevin. Your brother Richie was killed in Vietnam. What year was that, and how old were you when that tragedy occurred?
Well, he was killed January of 68, and I'm calling my documentary The First Day of Tet. And, you know, not actually the first day of Tet, but where he was, that was the first big battle, and they were much further north than Da Nang or Hue, and Hue didn't get attacked for another 10 days.
You left the police force, as you mentioned, short of your 20 years due to some problems that you later dealt with in therapy and
yeah.
rehab. But that eventually led to your turnaround in offering service to addicted children, in addition to taking through those years. But you focused on whether you think that the trauma of your brother's death had been a continuing factor or contributing factor to you?
Well, John, you know, I was 18 years old, Irish-American, and I didn't have the emotions of an 18-year-old. I was, you know, not mature enough. So I really couldn't grasp anything. As an Irish family, we didn't talk about it, or we never knew how he was killed. And I chose to believe that, as platoon commander, I said, well, maybe it was a sniper, and maybe it was a sole casualty. And that's all I knew for 45 years.
You subsequently moved to Long Island, built the massage therapy practice, married the children. After all this, what brought about the strong desire to understand more about your brother's death than what led you to the use of a documentary as the way of getting to your goal?
Well, the officers from the April 67 graduating from officers school were creating their legacy and making a memorial to the men that died, and the officers from that class had the most casualties out of any graduating class out of the Marine Corps Quantico program. And at that point in time, I came across my brother's radio man, and the platoon commander and the radio man are basically attached at the hip. They're very close. And he and my brother got along well. And then, it took me 2 months before I could finally sit down and have a conversation to find out the story. And then I read an article by my brother's commanding officer, and basically the commanding officer threw my brother under the bus and said, you know, pretty much put the blame for an awful lot of death and carnage on Richard, Lieutenant Richard Reynolds.
Now, there was your brother platoon leaders caught out of someplace like Iona, or was he OCS? Did he go into the Marines? How did he become an officer?
Manhattan College, and in some sort of program at Manhattan College where he went from a graduation of Manhattan College right into Quantico, Virginia.
Yeah, it's called, because I had friends in it, it's called the PLC. They do a summer camp either after freshman or sophomore year. They do one more and then they're commissioned on graduation. There was a fellow from Inwood that Chick would know named Tom Mooney who owned McSherry's for a while. And Tom was in the PLCs at Iona, very short fellow. And when he graduated, they said, Tom, you're too short for an officer. And he said, well, you had me go along all this way. And they said, well, we thought you'd grow. So he had to do 6 months as the Lance Corporal. So I know that you mentioned the Tet Offensive Chick was there on day one. Chick, tell us about you and Tet and how you happened to be there.
Well, it's a long story, John, but suffice, and I've said it before, suffice to know that they gave me a list, George Lynch, the Honorable Colonel. And we all know him as a war hero that, thank God, never got to war. But anyway, George had a list of six people in Inwood who were serving there in Vietnam in the end of October, the beginning of November, for me to go and see. I had taken on sort of a challenge to go over there and buy them all a beer, slap them on the back, tell them an Inwood supported them and all of that. And I said, okay, I volunteered for it. You know, I was on the beach a couple of months. I was a merchant seaman at the time after serving 4 years in the Marine Corps. So I know all about the PLC program and all of that. Anyway, when I got there, I found Tommy Collins, the person you were talking about earlier. I found him right away in Quinon. And then I went up to the Highlands and found Ricky Dugan. And then I went down to, where did I go? I went to On K and found Kevin McClune. Now, Kevin was born, I believe, in Long Beach. But he hung out in Chambers and Docks, and he had an apartment in Inwood while he went to school and worked in Manhattan. So he was one of the sports guys on the weekends in the pubs. And so Kevin was serving there at the time, and I found him, or he found me, actually. We almost literally ran into each other. And then I continued. By that time, my ship that I was sailing on sailed away, left me there. And I wound up in Saigon, and I had no passport or nothing. I had nothing. So I had to register with the authorities, all of that, pop, pop, pop. And in the meantime, I found Bobby Pappas in Long Beach. So they arranged for me to leave Vietnam on the morning of January 31st. It was New Year's Eve, and I was out celebrating. And I said, oh, I'm going home. Great. Wow, everything's fine. Yay. So the next day, I partied all night, and the next morning I was the first guy to get to the embassy so I could get a ride out to Tonsina to get to Manila, whatever. Obviously, some other guys got there before me and took over the embassy. And so I got stuck there. Late in the morning, and actually I got stuck for another 2 months in Vietnam. But I don't know. You know, I had six names on the list. I don't know where the list is today. But thank God, the four guys I actually found out of the six, they're all alive and they're all back here in the States. And that's what prompted the reunion that we allowed this company to video as a homecoming in the P&Ks. And it coincided with the book I was writing with my co-author, Joanna Malloy, who was a columnist for 25 or 30 years with the New York Daily News.
It's a funny thing, Chick. At the Inwood luncheon this week, Richard Shinnick was there, and we're talking about the State Department and everything. And we got into there's a whole security guard that guards the embassies who work for the State Department. And I said, gee, well, I thought the Marines did that. But he said, no, a lot of people don't understand that the Marines aren't at the embassy to protect the personnel. That's up to our people. They're at the embassy to protect all of the files, and they're required. And you told me a story of them blowing a hole in the door so they could get the files out, which all made sense then to me. Is that your understanding, what the Marines did? Chick, are you still with us? Huh. I don't know. what happened to him.
Maybe
there he is.
I'm sorry. My ear, my big ear hit the mute button.
Oh, okay. So what I said was, did you hear
what
I said? I
heard what you said about Richie Schenning.
Yeah.
And I heard his story.
Right.
And I think we're talking about two different times. I'm talking about 1968. I don't think Richie Schenning went into the State Department until the 70s, early 70s.
That's correct.
And he got involved in that security detail and the incident with the Red Brigade or something in Germany.
Right.
He was in Italy
right.
in the information, whatever. So he probably, and I suspect he had involvement in designing new security programs for embassies and all of the other U.S. government buildings around the world. But at the time, at least in Saigon, there were MPs, military, army MPs, at the front gate, the side gate, the consulate gate, and there was MPs at the front door of the embassy. There was two different things on the same property. There was a consul, U.S. consul's office, and a U.S. embassy.
Okay.
And there was definitely Marines standing at the front door. Now, they weren't in dress blues. Besides, it was too hot there for dress blues. But they were on duty in uniform at the front door of the embassy. And the embassy was a new building, a big, beautiful new building that was a replacement for one that had been blown up a few years before.
So now they blew this one up for them, right? Kevin,
the building survived fine.
I thought you told me they blew a hole in it to get stuff out.
No, there's not a controversy, but the bad guys took the property.
Right.
They were inside on the property. There are one or two guys still on the property inside hiding. A couple hiding upstairs in the embassy building, but that was not known exactly at that moment when all of the noise was going on. And we were firing, not me, I had no weapon at the time. We were firing into the embassy grounds, into the different areas, and returning fire from the bad guys. And at one time, I heard a tank, definitely a tank. It came from a side street, and this was on a big, wide boulevard. And then off the boulevard would be like a street like Cooper Street, a little bitty street. And off that little bitty street came a big American tank, a huge American tank. It's the first time I ever saw one in action. And it drove right up in front of the embassy building. And there was about an 8-foot wall around the embassy. And it was brand new, the place. And the tank turned its turret and fired one shot at that wall. Now, at the time, I had a headache from the night before celebrating. I'd already peed in my pants a couple of times that morning. And now I'm looking at our American tank blowing, shooting its cannon at, to me, was the American embassy. They clearly were, I realized, clearly aiming at that wall. But at that second, I thought I completely lost my mind. And then it turned around and drove away. Years later, I read a book about what happened in Saigon during Tet. And we've done research since. And the book said that there was no tank. There's no mention of a tank. But the whole there was a hole blown in the wall in the front of the embassy. And Viet Cong sappers supposedly planted charges there and blew a hole in the wall, and that's how they gained entry to the embassy. Well, as far as them blowing that wall, it's not true. I'm not hallucinating. I remember what I saw. As a matter of fact, I wasn't 10 foot from that tank. If it would have backed up and made a left turn, he would have crushed me. But then I was present when they retook the grounds, and I went in the grounds, in the side gate where the employees go in and out, and that's how they gain entrance. They killed the two MPs at the side gate, and they showed, and I saw the body of one of the drivers for the embassy, and I didn't actually hold his driver's license and his ID card in my hand, but one of the guys there, one of the security guys, was reading it and everything, and blah, 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 and that's how they got into the embassy ground. To this day, the Army or the State Department or Defense Department or whatever, they report that the first story, that sappers put explosives there and dot, 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 dot. And when we were writing our book, Joanna and I had a bit of a discussion on it. She says, Chicky, all the reports say this, dot, 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 dot. So I say, well, I hate to tell you this, but Joan of the people in Saigon lying. And now I don't know exactly why they did, but to this day, that's what their reports say. It was sappers. It was not sappers. It was just tank. So that's the only blowing of the wall that I remember specifically. There was no hole, Kevin, in the wall until the tank came and blew it open.
Yeah.
And that's, Kevin, the only hole in the wall.
Kevin, with all this discrepancies about what's going on, how much do you actually know about the events surrounding the brothers' death?
Oh, I've talked to many Marines that were out there with him that day, and I would say that overall picture, I know more about that battle than any one Marine that was involved in the battle.
Go ahead.
You know, I've interviewed, 30, 40 Marines, and I'm in the process of Skyping my interviews with them now.
I know that you intend to go to Vietnam. What do you hope to accomplish while there?
Well, you know, I have a story, and a lot of it is audio, or I have talking heads, and talking heads are not going to make a good documentary. So these people that tell the stories about the battle, when I'm in Vietnam, I'm going to be shooting copy. I'm going to be shooting the areas where the battle happened. Okay? Chronologically, the battle started with, surprisingly, the infamous Ron Kovic from Born on the 4th of July. He and a scout team were out there to do reconnaissance and, you know, to snoop and poop and find out what was going on. And, you know, there's a lot of different perceptions about what went on, and a lot of people felt that Kovic was a bit gung-ho and that he went beyond snooping and he engaged the enemy. And his squad of 10 engaged maybe 200 North Vietnamese Army.
Yeah, it's always possible because so many people were surprised by Tet that they thought there was some enemy stragglers. They didn't realize they're outnumbered about 20-1, you know?
Nobody did. I mean, however many cities, if there was 100 cities that were hit, I mean, that's a 1,000-mile strip from the DMZ down to Saigon. That's 1,000 miles, and they hit, 50 to 100 cities real hard. I mean, they almost had control of Hue.
Did either of you, and I'll start with Chick, and then I'll go back to Kevin, did either of you speak to Tom Collins about his experience during that trick? Did you? Did you hit the mute button again, Chick?
Yes, I did, John. I hit the mute button again. I got a big ear. Maybe I should have part of it chopped off. It doesn't work anyway. But yes, I did speak to Tom Collins. In the book, each one of the four guys have written their version of what took place when Chick arrived and whatever, and other things about what went on with them in Vietnam while I was there, before I was there, and after I left. So,
okay.
Yes, I spoke at length with Tom Collins.
And then what about you, Kevin, with Tom, who was there during Tet?
I haven't talked to Tom over the years. You know, I mean, I worked with Tom, and he knew that my brother was killed there, and I knew that he served there, but there wasn't we didn't elaborate much more than that.
Aren't you also looking for grants and funding for the trip and other documentary expenses?
Well, you know, right now everything is out of my pocket, and I want to be careful. I'm going to see some filmmakers next week, and to find out whether I have a project that will work. And when I have the confidence that I have a project that will work from beginning to end, that's when I'm going to create a GoFundMe fund, or, you know, communicate by email to everyone I know and ask them, you know, I'm going to offer them an eventual DVD in exchange for any donation, large or small.
Now, you don't have the website yet with information about how to contribute to your venture, do you?
No, but if they want to contact me and be on my list and I'll give them updates, they can easily go to kevin@mybrotheryourbrother.com.
Okay, and when I do the article about this, I will mention that as well as, once again, putting up Chick's website. Oh, we have some callers on.
Kevin, count me in, yeah, on your list, please.
Oh, I will, Chick. I'll be in contact with you.
Thank you.
We have
Thank
some
you.
Callers. Let's pick them up one by one. Who's calling from the 209 area code?
This is Rudy Molina.
And who are you, Rudy?
I was one of the scouts that went out with Ron Kovic on January 20th, 1968.
Okay. And do you have anything for Kevin, or is there anything you'd like to add for the audience?
Let me just interrupt. Rudy is going to be my travel buddy going to Vietnam, and we're going back to the scene of the crime. Both he and I are going back to this area of Qua Viet, and he's going to show me where his action took place. And my brother Richie's action took place maybe 100, 200 yards north of Rudy. And my brother's platoon were, the best word to describe it was, they were annihilated. 33 Marines were down to a fighting force of 7 in a matter of minutes.
Okay. Rudy, do you have anything you want to add to what Kevin just said?
Well, no, just that we're leaving March the 5th. We're going to go back to what Kevin said, to the crime scene up there in Qua Viet, and we're going to do this documentary with Kevin.
By the way, for Kevin and for Rudy, Chick's been back there 30 some odd years after he was there, and he said that they've treated them all very nicely in Vietnam, didn't they, Chick?
Yes, but again, I snuck in there. I went in there on a cruise ship, so I didn't have to deal with any government officials or anything. I just dealt with, you know, normal people, like the guy who worked in the lobby of the hotel and the shops and on the street, and they treated me very well. They treated me very well.
An interesting comment, John, is that I'm on some Marine Facebook sites, and one of the questions was, have you gone back to Vietnam? And the comments on that Facebook page was, you know, many of these Marines had gone back to Vietnam. Not only that, several of them have lived there and got married.
Yeah, the interesting thing, John McCain actually went back, and he had his friendly conversation with some of his torturers, and they all seemed to agree that they were just doing their jobs during the thing,
mm-hmm.
and they apparently all were getting along fairly well. We have another caller from the 678 area code. Let's see who that is. Who do we have from 678?
What are you talking about, me?
I guess I am if you're from the 678 area code. Who have I got? Do you want to join us, caller, or would you rather just listen?
Is that Terry?
I'll just listen, Kevin.
Okay.
Okay.
Chime in a little bit later, Terry, if you want. You know, Terry fought hand in hand with Richie, and Richie was his commanding officer.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, so how long do you fellas expect to be there, and do you expect to go to where Richie was before and to then follow the battle, or how long do you expect to be there?
Well, the tour is for 2 weeks, and the people on the tour are absolutely wonderful. They had in their plans to go there to stay in Quaviet for 1 day, and from there Richie's company was 5 miles south of the DMZ. So we're going up the beach across to the DMZ, and they have basically a museum there, which is the tunnels that were used for the North Vietnamese Army to bombard Richie. You know, they practically every day they had incoming artillery, and we couldn't knock them out. I mean, with fixed wing, we couldn't knock them out. With B-52s, we couldn't knock them out. The USS New Jersey couldn't knock them out.
So you'll be there for 2 weeks now. How long was Richie in the service before he was deployed, and how long was he actually in Vietnam before the?
Well, he arrived in Vietnam on August 10th, and killed in action on January 20th. So is that 5 months, maybe?
Yeah. There were other people from Inwood killed there. There was also, I mentioned Richard Schinnick earlier, his brother-in-law, I mean his brother John, flew combat missions over there. There were the bomber, and he was a co-pilot on it. He was a Marine pilot out of City College, and there was a number of people. There was John McGoldrick's younger brother. There was Jack Minogue's brother. It was
Michael Morrow.
Was that it, Chick?
Oh no, there's more than that.
Any more?
There was John Knuff.
It was the kid from the corner of Post Avenue,
oh, okay.
And 207th Street. I can't think of his name. But there, you know, 12 or 13 in the Inwood area.
Okay.
The research we found were 26 from Good Shepherd.
Wow. The ones they always think about are the ones that they had the parades with and they mentioned and everything, you know, the ones that are... George mentioned, or the ones who he knew, like John McGoldrick's younger brother and Kevin Minogue's younger brother. So yeah, I'm sure there were many who were closer to your age than mine, Chick, you know. So
yeah.
And and how did you, on a completely different topic, Kevin? Can you explain, which I really don't understand massage therapy.
Oh, massage therapy. You know, it's very interesting. My parents chose for me to be a policeman. And then at 40 years old, I chose to be a healer. And it was well worth the wait that I do what I love, and I've never worked since I got into the profession. I love what I do. I started off pioneering infant massage for crack babies in New York City hospitals. I still have a you know, a tremendous connection with infants that I work with infants out in Long Island, and the parents are just beside themselves. You know, how do you do it, Kevin? How do you make them sleep? How do you quiet them down? You know, I have a great touch with children, infants and newborns.
How did you happen to get into it at St. Luke's Hospital? How did you happen to understand the massage?
You know, as a substance user, previously a substance user, I volunteered to help out with the crack babies that moms were having the babies, and 15 minutes later they're back out in the street buying crack. So you had more babies than nurses, so they had a group of volunteers. So I would go in there and, you know, pretty much ran my own schedule with the nurses, and I'd go in and feed one or two or three babies, you know, whenever I had some free time. And, you know, I'm not a law guy, but I'll swear that those babies put me into massage school.
Well, and what was massage school? Where was it, and how much is involved, and what's the license requirement, if any?
Well, it's State Department of Education licensing. The school at the time was 1 year, and you know, now it's a lot more time. Back in 1990, maybe I paid $5,000 or $6,000 for the year of 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I was very lucky when I moved to Long Island. I was going to work in a gym, and the job didn't work out, and then I just went out and opened up my own practice, and I was very successful. You know, I had a gift from God with my hands, and you know, celebrities, a lot of regular customers. You know, I'm working with the rich and famous, you know, along the ocean.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had mentioned to you earlier, and I'll just mention that about Chick in the audience. Over the years, I've been close to Joe Reynolds, who hung around with some friends of mine, Artie Burns and the two Fitzgeralds and the late Bart Maroon. And the night of Warren Hennessy's bachelor party, and Chick, you know, was Warren well, it was after the bachelor party, I went into Chambers and I saw Artie, but then I went across to Doc Fiddler's, and I have never seen Joe so, number one, drunk and still awake, two, disconsolate, crying in his beer. And I said, what's the problem? And he told me that he had recently or just found out that his cousin Richie had been killed in Vietnam. And I must have been with him a few hours, and he just couldn't snap him out of it, and he was just screaming and rah, and how could this happen? And he was such a good kid, and he was my favorite cousin, and he was this and he was that. And I was just, you know, and I remember that, you know, 50 years later when I saw Kevin's note. How many of the Reynoldses do you remember, Chick?
Oh, my God. You know, I remembered them from the bars, and I know them. I know what they look like. They all, you know, there was no screaming redheads that I remember. There were no blondes. They were just another big Irish family in Inwood.
Now, I've heard your cousin Peter referred to as Peter Rabbit. Where do you get that name?
I don't know. Chicky is right about the family. We're all dark haired Irish, but Peter was sort of the exception. He was sort of reddish blonde guy, and how he got the name Rabbit, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know what?
Tommy,
I might have given him the name Rabbit because he didn't look like a Reynolds. And since I have a name Chicky at the age of 76, I don't get hung up on names.
Tommy Hanlon calls him that all the time, you know. So he apparently was talking to him yesterday. I was speaking to Tommy earlier. So let's go back to Rudy. Go ahead. Rudy, is there anything you want to add about your trip or about your time in Vietnam?
Well, I'm getting kind of anxious of getting up, get back there again and do this documentary and let the truth be known, because there's been a little bit of controversy there about what happened on January 20th, 1968, and Kevin and I will get out there and we'll let the truth be known.
What have you been doing, Rudy, since your Vietnam tours?
I'm retired.
Okay. And so what about our listener from the 618? Do you want to add anything to our conversation?
No, not necessarily.
Terry, you want to say hello? Tell John about the night of the 19th and my brother's talk about e-tools.
Well, as you know, Kevin, we had a platoon meeting that evening prior to going out on the 20th. And it was very interesting. Of course, where we were was just sand. Alina can tell you about that. And we were out behind the hooch up by one of the main bunkers for our platoon. Your brother was giving us a briefing as to what we might expect to go out the next morning and was giving us assignments. And, of course, one of the things that he said toward the end of the meeting, after he had told us what all we were going to carry and who would be the machine gunners that day, the next day. And, of course, I was not an Amtraker. I was infantry along with Washington and several others, Don Brain. We came up as a add-on replacement bunch for some of the guys that had rotated or been injured prior to that. We got in country on the 18th of December. So your brother to me was our lieutenant. I mean, he was the lieutenant of the platoon. I found him to be very personable, very straightforward, told just what he expected of us. And then that evening when we had the meeting, he made me a machine gunner and made John Washington a machine gunner. And some of the guys in the platoon kind of balked at that because we were new to the platoon. And he nipped that in the bud real quick, said that we were infantry, we were trained to be infantry, and we would carry the two heavy 30s. So he went on to make very specific what he wanted us to carry. He started to walk off, and he turned around and came back. He said, by the way, make sure all of you bring your e-tools with you. You might want to have to dig yourself a shallow grave. Then he kind of chuckled, and he said, well, I mean a shallow fighting position. Well, I may have been new to the platoon in Vietnam, but I didn't find any humor in that. It kind of upset me, and I kind of looked at some of the other guys, and they were rather taken back with it. But your brother was a fine person, Kevin, and I thought the world of him. I thought the world of Gunny Thompson and everyone else. Unfortunately, I didn't get to know him the way that a lot of people did, and I certainly didn't get to know a lot of the guys as closely as I would have liked to, but unfortunately, from that day, it all went down so quick and so bad. And your brother, bless his heart, he was, if not the first one killed, he was the second one killed. And it was just terrible. Where the scouts were, they couldn't see us, but I'm sure they heard everything going on. But it wasn't until you called me the first time and you had a kind of a Yankee attitude that day I didn't appreciate. But I think I set you straight that day. We had a good platoon, Kevin, and your brother was a tremendous Marine. He was a tremendous lieutenant. And I hope when you get there, if you do go to Mylop and you go to the berm and right there by the graveyard and by the pagoda, and you see just how flat that area was. And I don't know how it's changed. You know, next year will be 50 years. And since I got there, and then, of course, I was right out of boot camp and all. I hit Parris Island in July, and I landed in Vietnam on December the 18th. So they didn't waste too much time getting us in country. But to the scouts who made it out, I'm glad you made it out, my friend.
Thank you.
There weren't any of us that didn't get wounded or get some of the guys got killed, and we were lucky. But I guess you, along with myself and the ones that made it out, will always remember that. So, Kevin, that's about all I want to say because I guess you wrapped up.
I just want to mention that that Terry was seriously wounded getting off the Amtrak. I think both legs, one arm, and also a lot of shrapnel. And he was medevaced out to a ship off the coast in the China Sea. And he was there for 6 weeks. And he came back. And since there's so much a turnover of men there between wounded and killed and people finishing their tour, Terry returned on two canes and was placed back on active duty. That was basically the conditions up in Quaviette.
Terry,
it wasn't a nice place, but Kevin, Godspeed to you and Melina, and y'all get over there and bring all the facts back home. I know your brother would appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, Terry, thank you very much for that.
Buddy.
Terry, thank you very much for your service. And what you referred to as the smart northern attitude, that may have just been from the neighborhood that Kevin, Chick, and I came from.
Oh, that's a great way to try to cover it up, but no.
Chick, do you have anything that you want to add before we wrap it up?
No, not really. I don't have anything to say. I really don't.
That's
just
a first.
Listening to these. Well, I'm listening to some heroes talk about some real difficult time, and Chickie has nothing to add to that. I will say this. In my research and everything with this, I met a lot of guys who came back from there. And they're all heroes. They're all heroes. Nobody came back, even though they were living and breathing and healthy and everything. Nobody came back the same guy who went over there. Every one of them. And I love them all.
Thank you, Chick, and thank you, Terry, and thank you, Rudy, and Kevin. What else would you like the audience to know about Kevin Reynolds?
John, I just want to say that, for your listeners out there, if they just want to send me an email at kevin@mybrotheryourbrother.com, I'll send them out some clips from my documentary to get them started. I'll send out a clip, and I'll also send out a couple of clips of Terry Mulkey, the Marine we were just talking to. And he's a great storyteller, and whoever emails me, they will get those stories.
I'll mention that on the article that I send out, Kevin.
Terrific. Terrific.
What else might you like the audience to know about you personally?
This commanding officer, who basically blamed my brother for everything, and the evidence I've collected over the last 3 years, I don't have one piece of evidence to support his commanding officer, and I have buckets full of information supporting my brother. But there was a silver lining to this major story. Because when I read that story, that was the first time I started mourning my brother's death after 45 years. So in the last 3 years, I had never gone to my brother's
grave. I never had a relationship with my brother's widow. And since that, you know, I visit my brother regularly up in Gate of Heaven. When I'm in Jersey, I visit my sister-in-law. And on a daily basis of making my documentary, my brother's right there with me, helping me.
Wow. Thank you very much, Kevin. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, John.
A bit of commercial information. My last column in the Watch the Guardian, as I mentioned, is at website www.watchtheguardian.com, along with of columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and then critic John Simon. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com. Send any comments or questions about this show or any other to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Then once again, John Mack is JOHNMAC. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13, PRLs of the previous shows, and schedule of upcoming ones. I'll be back next week with journalist Kristen Palm, and as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Thank you, everybody.
Okay,
right.
John, thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, everybody.
Semper Fidelis, everybody. God bless.
God bless.
And thank you, Henry Mancini.